here tonight on 104.3. And tonight's story, I have two by the same author. Ben Laurie is the name of our author tonight. And the first story I'll be reading is UFO, A Love Story. And the second one is called The TV. So I hope you stay tuned. I'll be right back to give you a moment to get settled. Thank you. And this is Ms. G. I'm back with Telling Tales. And tonight's story by Ben Laurie is entitled UFO, A Love Story. The boy and the girl live in a small town. They have been dating for years. Neither has ever dated anyone else. Neither has ever wanted to either. One night the two are parked down by the lake when something comes floating in over the water. The something is round, pulsing, and bright. It hovers right over their car. "Stay here," says the boy. "I'll be right back." He starts to open the door. "No," says the girl, grabbing his arm. "I have to check it out," says the boy. The boy stands by the car, staring up at the light. He shades his eyes with one hand. He wants to speak, but can't think what to say. Then the thing moves away and is gone. "What was that?" says the girl, getting out of the car. She walks around and stands by the boy. He reaches out and holds her, then shakes his head. "No one's going to believe this," he says. The boy tells the town. He tells everybody in it. He tells absolutely every single person. He tells them all about the UFO, how it looked, how it sounded, how it flew. He tells them exactly where he and the girl saw it, when they saw it, and from what angle. And the girl stands beside him the entire time and nods and agrees and smiles. And yet, not one person in the town believes even a word of their story. "Aren't you a little old for this?" they say. "We thought better of you," they tell the girl. "How come you look like that?" the boy says in the car later on. "Like what?" says the girl. "Like you were lying," says the boy, "like you didn't believe it." "Well," says the girl, "maybe we were wrong." The boy drives her home. They sit outside her house. The girl gets out. He drives on. A few days later, the invasion begins. The UFOs are everywhere, every night. One by one, the townspeople see them. One by one, their eyes open wide. The saucers come in on anti-gravity beams, flashing their high-energy lights, making the weirdest woo-woo-woo noises, and emitting strange multicolored fogs. Every now and then, a tree catches fire and burns all the way to the ground. "It's an epidemic," says the doctor. "It's an emergency," says the mayor. "It's those crazy kids," say the spinsters on Grant Street. And the spinsters are, of course, correct, only it's not kids, it's just the boy. He sunk all his money, all his resources and efforts into just one thing. He's half the night designing modeled spaceships and the other half sneaking around town, sitting on rooftops and dangling his saucers down in front of people's windows with a fishing pole. And strangely enough, everyone's buying it, one after another, then the next. Pretty soon, there'll be no one left in town who hasn't seen a UFO. And those very people who laughed and scowled when the boy and the girl told their story are now going around swearing up and down that they've seen Martians out on their front lawn. And one day on the street, the mayor comes up and puts a hand on the boy's shoulder. son, he says, I have something to tell you. We may have been wrong about you. The girl, in the meantime, hasn't seen much of the boy. He hasn't been calling her back. He hasn't been coming to pick her up from work. In fact, she hasn't seen him at all. And so she walks home, all by herself, late at night, through the streets of the town. And she stands staring into the dark window of the travel agency, looking at the posters on the walls. Rome, Paris, New York City, the pyramids, Ayers Rock. So many wonderful places to be, and look at where she is. And then one night, the girl catches the boy. She's sitting in his room when he comes home. He's holding a spaceship in one hand. The other holds a flashlight and a megaphone. It's you, says the girl. You're the invasion. I was going to tell you, says the boy. The girl sits and stares at him for a long moment. Come away with me, she says. The girl puts her things into the car. I'll follow you in a little while, the boy says. I just have to finish what I'm doing here is all. Whatever you say, says the girl. Weeks go by. The invasion intensifies. TV crews start to come around. Local stations first, then regional affiliates. Big vans with generators arrive. The boy has a map up on his wall that's marked with circles and pins. Circles are for the people he hasn't yet fooled. He plans to put all the pins in. In the city, the girl gets a job in a diner. It's nothing special, but it pays the bills. On the days she has off, she goes out and explores. There's a whole city out there for her. Sometimes at night, the girl lies in bed and watches the headlights on the ceiling. She listens to the engines of the cars outside, idling at the streetlights, waiting. The girl feels like she's waiting, too, but she doesn't know what for. She only hopes that it'll come soon. And then one day, it walks through the door. It comes at work, in the shape of a man. He smiles and she smiles back. They start to go out. He takes her around town. It turns out he has a private jet. The man takes the girl to visit Paris and Rome. They go to Berlin and Prague. They fly down to Thailand and then to Australia. They go to see Ayers Rock. Sure, there are nights when the girl cannot sleep for thinking about the boy. Nights when she wishes he were beside her, when she can almost feel his arms around her. But when she turns, the boy is not there, and she remembers he stayed in the town. Those are the nights when the girl cries for hours. In the morning, she pretends she's fine. And then one day, the girl buys a dress and starts planning to walk down an aisle. She stands before the mirror, looks herself up and down. This is what you want, she tells herself. That night, the boy has a terrible dream. In his dream, he sees the girl. She's flying away in a plane with a man. The dream seems very real. The boy tries to call the girl, but he finds her number's been disconnected. He doesn't have her address. He doesn't know where she is. He has no way to get in touch with her. The boy sits and stares. Then he goes downtown to the junkyard and starts poking around. A pile of parts begins to form. The boy's there for quite some time. On the day of the wedding, in the back room of the church, everything is very quiet. A makeup artist is doing the girl's eyes. A TV is tuned to the shopping network. Out in the church, all the people are waiting, lined up in the pews. Suddenly, a man runs in. Aliens are attacking, he yelled. Sure enough, in the faraway town, a real UFO is in the air. Its laser guns are zapping the town. Real buildings are falling down. Back in the city, all the wedding guests are piled together in the room watching the coverage. That's right, says the anchorman. Aliens are real. And what's more, they're out to get us. The army rolls into the town with their tanks. TV cameras are everywhere. And suddenly the saucer turns and dives and slams into the door of town hall. For a while, there is silence as the townspeople gather around the crowded saucer. Back in the church, everything is still. Then a door in the UFO opens. The girl's eyes widen as a shadowy figure emerges and comes down the ramp. What's this? Says the reporter. It's a human being. Oh, the girl says. It's the boy. Why did you do it? Reporters are yelling. Why would you attack your own town? Is that thing on? The boy says to the camera. You bet your life, says the cameraman. I did it for this moment, the boy says to the world. I did it to get someone's attention. There's someone out there I have to find, someone I have to get in touch with. If you're out there, he says, and I hope you are, I just want to say I was wrong. I spent my whole life trying to fit in when I should have been with you, getting out. And there's something else, the boy continues, now moving closer to the camera. There's something I want everyone to know. A second later, the entire world gives one collective gasp. The girl is running from the church to her car. The train of her dress trails behind her. She's holding her bouquet in one hand. She throws it back over her shoulder. We don't understand, the announcer is saying. We don't understand what we just saw. We don't understand what on earth is happening. We don't know what's real anymore. The girl roars down the main street into town. Where is he? She screams out the window. He? Comes the answer. In the jail. The girl squeals into the municipal parking lot. Who are you? All the reporters yell. You can't go in there, the guards say. But the girl doesn't answer. Just moves into the jail, past security, down toward the holding cells. All around her, lights are flashing and sirens are going off. Doors are opening before her as she goes. The jail is starting to fall apart. The girl moves down the line of cells. Where are you? She yells. I'm here. At the end, a familiar voice calls out. The girl walks the last few yards, and as she goes, she feels something strange, a prickling on the top of her head. She reaches up, tentatively, and then she smiles. She's found the two antennae growing there. Oh, look, says the boy. You've got them, too. I do, smiles the girl. Same as you. And they look at each other in their own true forms. It was always just the two of us, says the girl. And now the bars of the cell are collapsing, and the floor is cracking apart. And the boy and the girl come together and kiss and fall into each other's arms. And meanwhile, outside in the parking lot, the whole town looks up as the jail crumbles away and something huge rises up from beneath with the boy and girl on top of it. Oh, look, people say. It's a real spaceship. And the boy and girl smile down. And everyone waves and dances and cheers while the ship blasts away from the town. You just heard me read UFO, A Love Story by Ben Lurie. This is Ms. G bringing you Telling Tales here tonight. I hope you enjoyed that story. And I'll be right back. Please stay tuned here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. Hi, this is Ms. G again, bringing you Telling Tales here tonight at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. And I hope you enjoyed that last story by Ben Lurie. He has quite the imagination. I have another story by him tonight. It's titled The TV. And just a reminder of where to find the recordings. If you miss any or want to hear it again, you can go to ktoo.org and check on program schedules in the middle of the page. Under KTO program schedule, you can go to Tuesday at 7 p.m., such as tonight, the 15th, and click on 7 p.m., and you'll see there are links there that you can click on besides email and Facebook. There's also, if you've missed any of the episodes, visit the archives, and it'll take you right there. So, next story is titled The TV by Ben Lurie. One day, the man wakes up and finds that he does not feel like going to work. He is not sick, exactly. He just doesn't feel like going to work. He calls the office and makes an excuse, and then he pours himself a bowl of cereal and sits down in front of the television. The man doesn't usually have time to watch television, so it takes him a while to find a show he's interested in. But when he eventually does find one, he sits wrapped, his cereal forgotten for a very, very, very long time. The show seems to last much longer than a normal show. In fact, it lasts all day. It is 5 o'clock before the main character finally leaves his job and heads home, prompting the credits to roll. The man sets his bowl of cereal aside and stares at the floor for a while. My God, he thinks. He gets up, goes into the bathroom, and takes a shower. As he washes, he thinks about the show he had just seen. He is shampooing his hair when suddenly he realizes the show was about him. Not kind of about him, not metaphorically about him, but actually about him. That's why the main character looks so familiar, he thinks, dunking his head under the water. But how could it have taken me so long to recognize my own self, he wonders. And how did they manage to find an actor who looks so exactly like me? The man stays home from work again the next day, claiming to have the flu. The show is on again, his show. Yep, there he is, arriving at work. He is wearing the suit he bought last week at Macy's. There he is, waving at the security guard he always waves at in the morning. Now he's walking down the hallway toward his office. Now he's moving inside. There's his desk, his chair, his inbox, and his outbox, his stapler, and his letter opener. It's amazing. The man can hardly believe it. On screen, he sits down at his desk, looks at the clock, and begins to work. The man does the same thing at work every day. It's not very exciting. But somehow watching himself do it from inside his apartment through the TV is absolutely fascinating. The man is mesmerized by all the little unconscious movements his on-screen self makes. He seems to chew on his lip a lot. Maybe that's why my lips are always chapped, he thinks, running a finger over them. He will have to watch that in the future. At lunchtime, the man on screen leaves the building and goes down the block to a little sandwich shop. It is Thursday, so the old guy who owns the place is in. He and the man have a conversation about the state of the world while the man eats his sandwich, roast beef, same as always, and drinks his coffee, black, same as always. Then the man returns to the office and works for the rest of the day. At 5 o'clock, he finishes up and heads out the door, and once again, the credits roll. This time, the man on the couch studies the credits carefully. Yep, there's his name, listed as both the main character and the actor. So it is really me, the man thinks in relief. It has been bothering him to think that an actor could so perfectly play him. It made him feel foolish to be so predictable, so reproducible. This way is much better. He feels proud of his role in the whole affair. The next day, the man goes to work. He apologizes for having been absent for the past couple of days, but no one seems to care very much. This does not surprise him, but still it seems a little sad. The man sits at his desk and does his work. It is not much fun. It has never been much fun, he reflects. But now, it seems particularly burdensome. He spends most of the time trying not to chew on his lip with little success. At lunch, he goes down to the sandwich shop. It is Friday, so the old guy who owns the place is not in. The man sits alone at a table in the corner and remembers the conversation that his on-screen self had with the old guy the day before. He smiles to himself about some of the witty and observant things the two of them said. Something nice happens in the afternoon. The man discovers that because his on-screen self did his work so well in the past couple of days, he is now done for the week. The man can hardly believe it. He almost never finishes his full workload. Usually he has to stay late on Friday night or even come in on Saturday or Sunday, or both, to get it all done. He sits at his desk, marveling at the knowledge that he can go home early, and then he does. He waves goodbye to the security guard on his way out. He drives home, feeling the wind in his hair and the sun on his face. At home, the man turns on the TV and is surprised to find that his show is on. There he is, wearing the same clothes he is wearing right now, but he is still at work. He is sitting behind his desk, hunched over a legal pad, writing something. How can this be? The man thinks. All the work is finished. He squints at the TV, trying to see what kind exactly his other self is working on. It is hard to tell. He seems to be writing up a list of some kind. The man notices that the man behind the desk is no longer chewing on his lip. That night, the program does not end at 5. The man in the office keeps right on working until almost 9:30. At home, the man has pulled a straight back chair up to the TV and tries to figure out what's happening, what his other self is doing. He cannot figure it out. When the man finally finishes working on his list, or whatever it is, he slides it into his briefcase and leaves work for the day. Again. At home, the man sits with his eyes glued to the front door, waiting for himself to walk in. He has lots of questions. He wants to know what this list is all about. 10, 11, 11:30, midnight. The door does not open. Suddenly, it occurs to the man that he can just open the briefcase and take out the list and read it. After all, it is his briefcase. He gets up and goes into the bedroom. Now, where did he put that briefcase? He can't remember. Where does he usually put it? He can't remember that either. In fact, he can't remember ever owning a briefcase at all. In the morning, the man awakens confused. He sits on the edge of the bed. He feels as if he has forgotten something, but he can't think what it could possibly be. The man gets to the couch early, so he won't miss anything, but it turns out he's already late. There he is in his office behind his desk with his feet up, reading a book. The book is lying open in his lap, so the man cannot tell what it is. It is very thick, though. There are other books stacked neatly on the desk. The man squints to make out the titles. Some of them seem to be about business management, but one is about calculus, and there are others about history and art, and one narrow volume looks like a collection of poetry. The man smiles when he sees that. What on earth is going on? When 9 o'clock rolls around, the man behind the desk closes the book he's reading. Is it the dictionary? And gets down to work. He works quickly and with an air of extreme concentration. At home, the man on the couch, though filled with admiration for his other better self, feels a twinge of jealousy, and even strangely, something like fear. At lunch, the man on screen does not go to the shop on the corner. Instead, he fixes his tie and heads down the corridor in the direction of his boss's office. The man on the couch cannot believe what he's seeing. He watches as he knocks firmly on the boss's door and then goes inside, closing the door behind him. When he emerges 15 minutes later, he is smiling. He stops and calls back to the person inside, something in the way of an affirmation, and then heads off down the hall, a spring in his step. With the remainder of his lunch hour, he eats a sandwich he has brought to work in a brown paper bag and drinks a bottle of water. The man at home does not know what's happening. He has never purposely gone to speak to his boss. In fact, he can't imagine ever wanting to do such a thing. Still, he admires his on-screen self for doing it. Perhaps something good will come of it. Maybe a raise. The man goes into the kitchen and grabs a bag of cookies from the cupboard. But when he returns to the living room, he finds that his on-screen self is left for the day. His office is clean, his outbooks box is full, his pile of books has disappeared. He begins to get antsy. Where has he gone? There was no way to know. What did he say to his boss? What was on the list? And what are all the books for? The man is beginning to feel nauseated, thinking about it all. He is making himself sick. He has to think about something else. Perhaps there is something else on TV. The man changes the channel. There is a cartoon about a coyote, a commercial for an exercise machine, someone talking about the weather, and oh wait, what's this? There is the man again. He is in his car now, driving down a street that the man on the couch finds unfamiliar. He stops outside a building, an office building, and goes inside. He speaks to a receptionist and is then ushered into a conference room. In the room are a number of men, all of whom look very serious. The man on the couch is frightened, but his other self looks perfectly at home. He places his briefcase carefully on the table, unlocks it with a pair of decisive clicks, and opens it up. Inside is a stack of papers. He begins to hand them out, and as he does, begins to speak. He speaks about things the man on the couch doesn't understand, stocks and bonds and financial matters, things like that. The man on the couch furrows his brow, trying to follow it all. He can't. But he is relieved to see that the men in the room seem to be following it quite well and, what's more, seem to be happy with what they're hearing. At the end of the meeting, the men rise, smiling, and congratulate the man on what he has said and done. Cigars are passed around, and the man takes one and sees himself smoking it with a practiced air, despite the fact that he has never smoked a cigar in his life. I would never want to, since they're disgusting. Still, he has to admit, it is quite enjoyable. When the man leaves the meeting, however, the show does not follow him. It stays in the conference room with the other men, and after a while, despite the fact that these other men are beginning to seem vaguely familiar, the man on the couch starts to tire of their banter. He figures he's probably returned to the office by now, so he changes the channel again, and then again. He is almost back to his original station when suddenly he recognizes himself on a show about doctors. He is in surgery, raising his hands in the air as his nurse slips a pair of latex gloves over them. He almost didn't recognize himself, thanks to the mask that covers half his face. But there's no doubt about it. It's him. After all, if a man can't recognize himself, what can he recognize? This is his first day as a surgeon. Apparently, the man has been going to night school. The man on the couch is impressed. He didn't know you could go to night school to become a surgeon. And yet, it turns out that he has actually been doing it this whole time. He marvels at himself as he cuts open some poor man's chest and begins to operate on his malfunctioning heart. He hopes the operation will go well, and it does. The nurses congratulate him as he sews the man back together. Later on, they all go out drinking, and the man makes love to one of the nurses, the most attractive one, in the bathroom of the club. It is the best sex the man has had in years. On another station, the man finds himself foiling a gang of jewel thieves. He has infiltrated the gang thanks to some ingenious plastic surgery and a number of carefully constructed lies. He waits until the last possible moment, and then he springs the trap. Everyone is arrested and found guilty. And after the trial, the man is singled out for bravery and is given a medal, and a monument is erected to him in a park downtown. Lovers sit on a bench beside the monument and feel safe. It is sad, though, because the man's father died in a botched robbery, and while what the man has done makes him feel that he has finally evened out the situation, he knows that nothing he can do will ever bring his father back from the dead. Still, perhaps his work has prevented other innocent fathers from being killed. Meanwhile, on another station, the man is a scientist who has invented a way to bring people back from the dead. He uses it to bring back his wife, who died a few years ago. But then he learns that she didn't love him after all, and that it is better not to mess with bringing people back from the dead. He is a better man for learning this, but he can't help feeling sorry for himself as he misses his wife and the love that he thought she had for him. On another station, the man has become the head of a warlike country and is threatening to unleash Armageddon on the world if his barbarous demands are not met. The man becomes afraid of himself and changes the channel. Now he is murdering a small boy in a field with a rusty knife, and he feels absolutely terrible. Whatever happened to night school and poetry books? The man is confused. He is proud of himself and everything he has accomplished. Very proud indeed. He always knew he had it in him. But at the same time, he is scared of what he sees. There are things about himself that he doesn't want to know, things he does that he doesn't want to think about. He wishes there were some way he could choose what he does and does not do, but it is beyond his control. He runs rampant across the world, helping and killing and saving and selling, buying and raping and stealing and feeling and making love and running away and laughing and crying and dying and being born and dying and being born and dying and being born and dying and being born. Eventually, the man comes to see that he has a mind, that his mind is like a fist wrapped tightly around a single thought. He cannot open the fist to look at the thought for fear that it will fly away, but he knows that it is very important and that he must hang on to it, no matter the cost. He stares at the fist and hopes that it is very strong. He feels like a man who has fallen asleep at the wheel and has awakened to find his car lurching off a cliff. He has applied the brake, he has swung the wheel to the side, he has offered up a silent prayer, but it is too soon to see whether he has done these things in time. He can only wait for the next moment to come and hope as hard as he can. Finally, the next moment comes. The man opens his fist and realizes that the thing in his hand is not a thought, but the end of an electrical cord. He looks down and finds that the electrical cord leads to the television, now a dark, silent box lying on the floor at his feet. The man feels a rush of triumph. He has come out on top. He has won. He grins to himself as he contemplates his next move. He decides that the best thing to do is take the TV down to the trash and get rid of it. And this is exactly what he does. But in the stairwell, on the way back from the trash, the man passes himself carrying the television down to the trash. He stops to congratulate himself on his wisdom and strength, but his other self averts his eyes, hoping not to be noticed. The man begins to take offense and is about to say something when both of them are elbowed aside by the man who is carrying his TV back up from the trash. The man hurries after himself, yelling, "No, no, I don't want that anymore." But he doesn't listen. As they enter the apartment, the man on the couch looks up from the TV in irritation. Why can't everyone leave him alone? The room was packed with versions of the man running here and there, talking to himself about this and that, making plans on the phone and staring out the window, and falling in love and falling out of love, and finding himself loved and unloved and hated and feared and liked and disliked and ignored and unknown and known. He is fired, promoted, rehired, and refired, has found a new place to live, and is moving out, is moving in, and repainting, is in the other room dying, and in the kitchen being born. There is too much going on. The man walks out the door and down the hall and into the next apartment. "Mommy, mommy," his children scream, "what's for breakfast?" The man makes French toast and waffles and ham and eggs and pancakes and cereal and Pop-Tarts and brownies and hot dogs and hamburgers and baked Alaska and a birthday cake in the shape of a castle and pours glasses of milk and orange juice and coffee and Tang and Kool-Aid and water and puts ice in all of the glasses. He takes the kids down to the bus stop 700 times and he drives the bus to school. Drunk, sober, hungover, on acid, pot, cocaine, uppers and downers are nothing at all. It doesn't matter in the least. He gets in an accident every foot of the way, or he doesn't. At school, he gets in a fight on the playground and is sent to the office, or doesn't, and isn't. Or does, and isn't. Or doesn't, and is. He gives himself a good lecture, maybe. Winks at the secretary he has or has not been banging for the past 2 weeks, or 4 weeks, or 10 weeks, or no weeks. Then hurries slowly to the women's room, realizing that it is or is not his time of the month. Mops none or half of all of the gym and goes out back to have a smoke or stare at the sky or remember the time he accidentally ate a spider or became president or something else or nothing else or everything else. He flies to the next town and over and perches in all the trees and then falls to the ground in several different countries and is blown away by the wind, which hammers endlessly in all the ears he has, more than he is capable of counting. Sometimes the man cries himself to sleep at night. But usually he just changes the channel. He has not been able to find his way to the office. He doesn't know where they put it. He rings and rings, but the nurse no longer answers his calls. One night he discovers that his lips are horribly chapped. This strikes him as the worst thing that has ever happened. And for a moment he sobs uncontrollably. Then, once more, he opens the fist. You just heard Ben Lurie's The TV. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. I hope you enjoy the show. Good night until next time.